MacCast, Sunday, June 7th, 2015. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, we have WWDC, the Worldwide Developers Conference, right around the corner, actually happening on Monday. It is Friday. It's Sunday. We've already gone through the weekend. It's Sunday as I sit down to record this podcast, and I am looking forward to WWDC, but those of you who have been listening to the MacCast for years probably know that it's also the week that I take my summer vacation. So I am going to be out of town. I will be on the central coast of California enjoying the beach, doing a little bit of camping. I will take a break, though, and head to a Starbucks to actually follow along with the live stream so that I am at least up to date when I get back and can report back on my thoughts on WWDC, because I know you look forward to hearing that, but it'll probably be a little more in-depth, and I'll have some of the analysis that happens afterwards. And in case you're curious and want to be a little bit stalky, I will be at the Starbucks in Grover Beach, California. So if you can find me, you're more than welcome to. I don't mind a little bit of stalking. It'd be really cool to actually meet some fans of the MacCast. So if you're in that area and want to hang out for the keynote, just track me down and we'll see you there. But for today, I've got some really great stuff to get into. Of course, a lot of rumors leading up to WWDC is what we're going to be talking about. Updates on Apple's music and TV streaming services. I have a little bit of information about an exploit that surfaced for the Mac this past week. Also, some exciting news surrounding the next generation of Thunderbolt and its relation to the new USB-C connector. We've got more updates on HomeKit. Apple Watch is finally maybe coming to retail. I'm going to run down some latest numbers from various sources on various Apple products and information, and why retailers are saying they're not supporting Apple Pay. We've got that. Also, a lot of great feedback and stuff from you. I have one of you asking a question about how big of a hard drive you can get into a Mac Pro. We're going to talk a little bit about better passwords and storing them securely, and some Apple Watch feedback from one of you, along with my thing of the moment. And I know last time I promised you that, and if you were listening closely, I forgot. I never gave you my thing of the moment last week. So we're going to do that this week for sure. But before we get into all of that, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Gazelle. Hey, you want to get a new iPhone or iPad, maybe a new Apple Watch. It's going to be in retail stores in a couple weeks. And, well, maybe you want some cash to help pay for that. Gazelle is a great way to get that cash, because what they do is they buy your old devices or your extra devices. Maybe you already upgraded. You've got an old iPhone or iPad laying around. It's a great way to get some cash to help you make a new purchase, do an upgrade, or use it for whatever you want. And what's awesome about Gazelle is they give you a fair and upfront offer. You go to the website, answer a couple questions about the device that you want to sell to them. They'll even buy broken devices, so don't worry about that. Just fill out the form. You'll get an offer right there on the screen. And they really make the process of selling your used iPhones, iPads, and other Mac products really simple and Apple-free. It's one of the reasons I love them. So just go to gazelle.com. That's G-A-Z-E-L-L-E.com. Find your item. Tell them a little bit about the condition. You'll get a risk-free offer on your gadgets. They do free shipping. And in many cases, will even send you a box. So they make it sending it in so easy. And then once they receive your product, you'll get paid fast by check, by PayPal, or you can get an extra 5% on your offer if you opt to get paid through an Amazon gift card. And the process really just takes a minute or so. So do it today, because every day you wait, your gadgets will lose value, and you want to make sure you get the best possible offer. And Gazelle has handled over 2 million trade-ins to date. They've paid out over $175 million to their customers. And 90% of the people using Gazelle report having a great experience. And I certainly have had a great experience every time I use them. So what are you waiting for? Take a minute, Find out what your iPhone, your iPad, or other Mac products are worth by going to gazelle.com. And a big thank you to them for their continued support of the MacCast. Let's kick things off today and talk a little bit about Apple's rumored music and TV streaming services. First off, the Wall Street Journal thinks that Apple will announce its Apple Music streaming service at WWDC on Monday. Interestingly, they claim that it will exist, at least at first, alongside Beats Music and not actually be a replacement for that. They also claim that Apple is rushing to finish up the deals just in time to make the announcement on Monday. The labels are supposedly squeezing Apple pretty hard to get a better deal for themselves, and that has been slowing down the process. They're really trying to get more money out of Apple than they do out of Apple's chief rival in the streaming space, Spotify. Bloomberg says that the labels are pushing to get about a 60% revenue share. That's about 5% more than they receive from Spotify. And I guess negotiations have been pretty tough. In addition, the label squeezing has also had an impact on the service's reported price. For a time, it was being rumored that Apple wanted to offer the service at a lower $7.99, about $7 a month. But they had too much pushback from the music partners. Pricing is expected to be set at $10 a month, which is pretty much in line with other streaming services on the market. Now, one thing that may give Apple's service an edge over their rivals would be a longer free trial period than other services. Many sites are claiming that Apple plans to offer a free 3-month trial period to new subscribers, which give you a pretty good time to actually try out the service before you have to commit to that $10 a month plan. So I think that's a pretty good deal. Now, separately, it's also being said that Apple will add some updates to their existing iTunes radio service, specifically that they're going to have stations with DJs to actually create better curated playlists. So they've been making some hires. They hired a DJ from the BBC in UK, and we've heard about some other DJ hires, and supposedly those guys are being brought on board to beef up iTunes Radio, which, if you use iTunes Radio stations, sometimes they can be a little bit off. You know, you put in one station thinking you're going to get one kind of music, and it doesn't really work out. So this is supposed to help with that. It's also being said that they have plans to use celebrity guest DJs from time to time to help round out the service. Now, separately, Recode says that despite Apple's desire to announce a new streaming TV service at WWDC, they may not be able to do so. It's being said that Apple has told their TV partners that they planned to make the announcement, but that has now been delayed due to some disagreements over licensing. Another possible sticking point is the fact that Apple has been trying to secure local TV rights for the streaming service, something that a lot of other services aren't able to offer, which is those local TV channels, and it would definitely set Apple's service apart. But that is very hard to come by, especially since a lot of the networks actually don't control the rights to their local content or the content in local markets. So that makes the whole negotiation process much more difficult. And I guess that slowed things down to the point where Apple is probably not going to be able to announce streaming TV as something at WWDC. But that's the latest that we know about music and streaming services from Apple. An interesting security story came up this week. Apparently, back in 2014, there was a presentation at the Chaos Communication Congress, and it showed what is looking like a pretty scary exploit, especially if you own a mid-2014 or earlier Mac. Now, why it took so long for this story to kind of make the rounds in the Mac community, I'm not really sure, but it showed how a vulnerability in the bootscript table could be used to rewrite the firmware on a Mac when it wakes up after being in sleep mode. Now, if you didn't understand all of what I just said, don't worry, because I didn't either. Luckily, the folks over at iMore had our back, and basically they distilled down what that means into the fact that your Mac has something called the Unified Extensible Firmware Interface, or the UEFI. And that is used when you're booting up your Mac and then moving into the operating system. So it's used to boot from firmware and into the OS X operating system. In the old days, we used to use what was called the BIOS. So if you know what that is, this is basically the modern Mac's equivalent of that. And with this exploit, apparently what happens is during boot, the firmware on your Mac is actually read-only. So it can only be read from. But in this research, the research showed that when you were waking your Mac from sleep on a mid-2014 or newer or older, rather, Mac, that the firmware at that point was writable, which is what this what an exploit could take advantage of, to actually write malicious code into your firmware. And then that malicious code could be used to allow an attacker to remotely control your Mac. Pretty scary stuff, right? It sounded pretty serious to me. But again, iMore dug in and they claim that this type of attack is likely to be more of a targeted attack, meaning that it's not something that is going to be used to randomly sort of mass target Macintoshes, that you'd have to be a target of someone wanting to actually spy on you or gain control of your system. As a matter of fact, there's already claims around that the NSA was reportedly doing exactly this with this exploit, since it's been out and known for about a year, that they were kind of intercepting Mac shipments to key people that they wanted to spy on, and then using this exploit to put software on there to monitor and control their systems. Now, I don't know whether or not that's going on or not. I don't want to even get into that discussion. But needless to say, this is one of the reasons why a lot of folks are saying you don't need to worry about this too much. The iMore report goes on to say that the attacking code also needs root access. But then something that confused me a little bit, later in their report, they say that running as an admin account, you would also be vulnerable. Now, on the Mac, an admin account isn't truly a full root account, but the admin account does have the ability to do some root-like stuff. And for like some more serious root-level stuff, it will ask you to authenticate. So I don't know if, you know, there was a Trojan or something running on your system that tried to install this exploit as it was waking from sleep, if you would be asked to authenticate or not. None of the reports that I saw were very clear about that. But it is the kind of thing where if you had a malicious software on your system or someone had physical access to your machine, they could execute this exploit. And so to me, that seems a little bit scary, which is the main reason I'm pointing this out. I don't think, you know, it's a super serious problem, but I guess more of the reason I wanted to bring this up was because this has been around for a year. Apple fixed it in mid-2014 and newer models. So sounding like after this report came out, they sort of fixed things. Why they haven't gone back and updated the firmware in older models is a little bit confusing. So I think that's something they do need to do, which is one of the reasons I wanted to mention this. I also just wanted to make you generally aware of the exploit, because there are a few things, if you're worried about it, that you could do to protect yourself. The first and most obvious one is don't run apps from unknown sources or untrusted developers. Really, this is why we have Gatekeeper on our system, right? Because in order to get hit by this, again, someone would need to have physical access, or you would need to run some sort of malicious software that would attempt to install this during your Mac's wake from sleep period. The other thing would be don't run as admin. You know, don't run your main account as admin, because apparently you need admin access to actually get this exploit installed. And then lastly, if you are running as admin and you're worried about it, you could simply just not let your Mac go to sleep. So go into Energy Saver, tell it not to go to sleep. You can still use Display Sleep, because that's not the same thing. And then just wait for Apple to hopefully issue a firmware update for your Mac. So again, I think this is not something that a lot of us need to really worry about, but certainly something to be aware of. Intel this week announced the next generation of Thunderbolt, Thunderbolt 3. And I think the most interesting thing about the announcement is that it sheds a little bit of light on why Apple is transitioning, or appears to be transitioning, to that new USB-C connector. A lot of people were wondering, why the new MacBook only had USB-C and there wasn't any other ports in there. Well, turns out Thunderbolt 3 is going to make a change, moving from using the mini DisplayPort connector to using a USB-C connector. Thunderbolt 3 is going to use a superset, or be a superset of USB 3.1, which is the same USB technology that USB-C uses. USB-C currently can run at 10 gigabits per second, but the Thunderbolt 3 will be capable of speeds of up to 40 gigabits per second if you use high-end cables. Sounds like if you don't, you're going to get about twice that, about 20 gigabits per second. It will also get a lot of the other USB-C and USB 3.1 advantages, including supporting DisplayPort 1.2, third generation PCI Express, and power up to 100 watts. Now, don't get too excited if you have a MacBook, though, because Thunderbolt 3 and USB-C are not equal. They are two different technologies. They're just sharing the same connector. So your MacBook's USB-C will not be able to do Thunderbolt 3, as it's going to require some new hardware, controllers, those sorts of things. So you can think about it like this. Basically, you'll be able to connect USB-C and Thunderbolt 3 devices to a machine that has and supports Thunderbolt 3 on the USB-C connection, but connecting a Thunderbolt 3 device to a computer that has USB-C connectors only will not work. As far as when it's expected to arrive, we should see it later this year, because it's probably going to require Intel's next generation Skylake processors. And I would fully expect that we will see updated MacBook Pros with Thunderbolt 3 and Skylake processors probably in the fall, if I were going to be putting some bets on it. And what's awesome is that all the same connectors and cables and devices that you have that support USB-C will continue to work when you get a Mac with Thunderbolt ports. So that means monitors, hard drives, devices, they're all going to be on that same connector, which is going to be totally awesome. So I would expect that when we have an updated MacBook Pro, it's just going to have Thunderbolt 3 connectors, which is going to enable you to do USB, USB-C, Thunderbolt, and all the other things that you can adapt to. Oh, power and your DisplayPort monitors and what have you. So that'll be really, really cool. This announcement also, as I was saying, explains a lot of things. Apple's addition to of USB-C as the only connector in the MacBook Pro, sort of getting us ready for this transition to USB-C. Also, Apple's recent update of the 13-inch and 15-inch MacBook Pros, where they used only updated Haswell processors and not the new Intel Broadwell processors, which the MacBook Pro appropriate versions of those chips actually arrived just about a week after Apple made that update. So just right after Apple revved the MacBooks, Intel says, oh, here's Broadwell processors that would work well for that model. Well, Apple didn't go with them because they're probably waiting on Skylake, which is going to be able to drive Thunderbolt 3. And Skylake is said to be on target for being updated later this year. So why would Apple want to upgrade to a chip that they're just going to have to replace in a couple months and one that's not going to be able to support Thunderbolt 3? That wouldn't have made a lot of sense. And so now with this announcement, looking back on it, it's like, okay, now we know what's going on. This is why Apple was holding off to do a major MacBook update with new Intel processors. And again, why I think it will happen in the fall. When Apple updated their Apple TV software to version 7.0, you remember one of the things that was noted was that they added in HomeKit support. This was well in advance of any HomeKit products actually hitting the market. Well, this week, the first round of HomeKit compatible devices started appearing, and Elgato's Eve line was one of those. And immediately, folks noticed something interesting in the documents that came along with those devices or were posted online with those devices with respect to HomeKit. Basically, they said that when you were away from home and wanted to control your Eve devices, it required an Apple TV third generation or later, along with the Apple TV software 7.0 or later, and an iPhone, iPad, or iPod Touch with iOS 8.1 or later, basically confirming that having an Apple TV would allow you to be able to remotely control your devices, your HomeKit devices that were on your network. So while that means the Apple TV is not necessarily like a command center or a full-blown hub, something that's going to have an app on it that would allow you to configure and control all of your HomeKit devices, we at least know that it's going to be able to act as a bridge, giving you remote control access of your HomeKit connected devices, which is still pretty cool. And actually, it's something that was confirmed by Apple's own support documentation, which showed up on their website this week. They had a note in there saying that after signing in with the same Apple ID on an iOS device and an Apple TV, that users can use Siri commands to remotely control locks, lights, thermostats, smart plugs, and other HomeKit-enabled accessories. So it sounds like you'll still have to set up and configure your different devices with their individual apps, but that once they're all connected together on your network with your Apple TV, that at that point you'll be able to command and control them with Siri from anywhere. And that's pretty cool. I mean, that's starting to feel like the Star Trek future, where we have, you know, the computer, you're able to use your watch or your iPhone to issue a voice command and control things all over your house, and they'll all be connected together and talking together. So this is finally the promise of HomeKit, and we're finally getting to that point, and I'm very excited about it, if you can't tell already. But at this point, it's unclear if we're actually going to get any new Apple TV hardware on Monday. A lot of people are thinking that we're not. I think Apple will actually announce some new tools, some new development kits, but that they're not going to be ready to reveal any new hardware or talk about any of their hardware plans. I think there is some new Apple TV hardware in the works, but we're probably going to get a separate announcement, and I'm going to guess that it would be in the fall. And as a matter of fact, the New York Times is reporting that their sources claim that we're not even going to see an SDK for the Apple TV at WWDC, let alone any new hardware. I'm going to disagree with them a little bit. I think we will see some software stuff, but the hardware will come much later. But regardless, HomeKit is going to be part of that integration with the Apple TV. And I'm looking forward to being able to play around with some of these devices. I recently upgraded, as you may know if you've listened to that show, I upgraded some switches and things in my house to the Insteon platform, because Insteon was one of the few companies that came out and said, yes, we are going to have HomeKit support. Now, unfortunately, it's going to require me buying a new Insteon hub for my house, so I need to get one of those ordered up. But as soon as I do that, I'll be able to play around with this a little bit and report back to you. If you can't wait for that, I've already seen some reports online from iMore and some other sources that detail exactly how HomeKit support works with your Apple TV and Siri and your devices, and it looks really easy to set up and control. And so I think Apple is ultimately going to be really delivering on this promise of bringing everything together and making it easy, at least a little bit easier to set up home automation. Looks like now, finally, almost, 2 months after the launch, the Apple Watch will finally be available in Apple retail stores, at least in a couple weeks. Apple announced Thursday that beginning June 26th, some models of the Apple Watch will be available for purchase at its retail stores. Now, they didn't elaborate on which models specifically, but we know at least one that will not be there is the Space Black with Link bracelet. The reason for that is Apple is still trying to fulfill their orders, and not long after the announcement of the June 26th availability of some models, the Apple sent emails to customers who ordered the Space Black Apple Watch and were still waiting on them to say the Space Black will not show up in stores until all current online Space Black Apple Watch orders have been shipped. So at least they're doing that. It would be pretty awful if you had pre-ordered a Space Black one and you could get it in the store before you actually got yours shipped to you, right? I think that's called the David Sparks syndrome. And just so I don't continue that inside joke just for myself. David Sparks actually pre-ordered one of the Pebble watches through the Kickstarter campaign, and they started showing up in retail stores before David actually got his watch. And if you talk to him about it, he'll tell you it wasn't a really great experience. So Apple avoiding that one, at least with the Space Black Apple Watch. Other thing that's happening is Apple also said that watches will be available in 7 more countries beginning on June 26th. If you live in Italy, Mexico, Singapore, South Korea, Spain, Switzerland, or Taiwan, you will be able to, I would assume, order an Apple Watch. Whether you'll actually be able to walk into a retail store in one of those countries and get one, I don't think that's going on. But you'll be able to buy one, have one shipped to you, and it's looking like ship times are pretty good right now. So I think Apple has finally got a handle on Apple Watch quantities and availability. Let's get into some Apple rankings, numbers, and market shares. This week, the 2015 Fortune 500 rankings came out, and Apple is number 5 on the list. The Fortune 500 lists U.S. corporations in terms of revenue. If they were listing companies in terms of value, however, Apple would be on the top of that list. Still, Apple is the top technology company on the Fortune 500. The next closest company being their iPhone partner, AT&T. They came in at number 12. The other companies that were ahead of Apple in the Fortune 500 are Walmart, Exxon Mobil, Chevron, and Berkshire Hathaway. Adobe says the Apple TV is the top set-top streamer in the online video market. They did a report from their digital index team and say they examined 200 billion online video plays, 2.85 billion TV Anywhere authenticated video streams, and 500 billion website visits, and that the Apple TV was able to double its share of premium video viewing in just one quarter, moving from 5% in the fourth quarter of 2014 to 10% in the first quarter of 2015. And the most significant part of that is that Apple TV beat out Roku. And I would say that's a pretty significant milestone for Apple TV growth. So the Apple TV definitely gaining in popularity. And I think as Apple announces some of the new products and services, they're only going to do that much better. On the iOS side, iOS devices also widened their lead as top video streaming devices, accounting for 47% of premium video views, according to the Adobe report. And then the latest Comscore numbers say that Apple's share of the U.S. smartphone market grew nearly 2% over the past quarter. Apple now claims 43.1% of the U.S. smartphone market, according to the report. Apple's main competitor, Samsung, came in second with 28.6% share, but their share actually dropped a tad in the quarter, down by 0.7%. LG, Motorola, and HTC were the other smartphone makers in the top five with 8.4%, 4.9%, and 3.7% of the U.S. market, respectively. And then finally in the news for this week, Reuters seems to think they know why you cannot use Apple Pay at some of your favorite retailers. Reuters asked 98 of the top 100 National Retail Federation merchants if they plan to support Apple Pay this year, and reportedly only 25% said yes. This actually contradicts Apple's claim that about half would begin to accept Apple Pay this year. Remember, this was supposed to be the year of Apple Pay. Now, when asked why they weren't planning on supporting Apple Pay, the report went on to claim that retailers said insufficient customer demand was the biggest reason. They also said that the inability to get customer data on buying habits was the second biggest reason they were not supporting Apple's payment platform. And then finally, that cost of installation and support of other contactless payment solutions was the other reason they were planning on dissing Apple Pay. Now, I and my cohorts over at the iOS show were calling poppycock on this report, at least on the number one reason why retailers are planning on not supporting Apple Pay. We think that the number one reason is actually the number two reason. that retailers want to be able to track your buying habits, and they can't do that with Apple Pay, so they're looking to other platforms, or I think maybe even waiting to see. I think some of them are waiting to find out if the already, in my mind, failed Currency program from the merchant customer or merchant consumer exchange, rather, will gain any traction. And so far, it hasn't, and I don't think it's really going anywhere. What it comes down to is retailers hate credit cards. Actually, more specifically, they hate the credit card fees that go along with credit cards, and they also want to mine the heck out of our data. They want to know where we're going, what we're buying, when we're buying it, how much we're spending, and they can't track that stuff with Apple Pay. So, you know, I'd love to get your opinion on this, but you know, that's really what I'm thinking. So it's interesting. You know, I think it's easy to say, well, customers aren't demanding Apple Pay, so, you know, we're not putting it in, and kind of putting it back on the customer, saying it's our fault that we don't get Apple Pay. And you talk to anybody who has Apple Pay or uses Apple Pay, and I would say it's completely the opposite. Now, luckily, some of the other major MCX players like Best Buy and Target have come out and said that they will support Apple Pay. So I think long term, we will see Apple Pay adopted more and more, and retailers are going to come on board, but it's going much more slowly, I think, than Apple really wanted it to. So I guess we need to get out there and do our part. We need to demand Apple Pay at our local retailers, since they're saying we're not demanding it enough. And it's actually something I already do, much to the chagrin of my family, because I will go into a retailer knowing that they don't support Apple Pay and ask every single time, do you support Apple Pay? Do you support Apple Pay? And I'm hoping that by berating the cashiers enough that will get worked up the chain of command, and eventually, you know, the managers will hear it, and then the regional managers, and then the corporations themselves. Because I don't know about you, but Apple Pay is freaking awesome, and I want to be able to use it everywhere. And I know those of you who are in other countries are probably screaming at me right now, like saying, we just want to get Apple Pay at any retailer. And I think it's the same sort of thing. Apple needs to get on the ball. They need to push this harder, because I think this is a really cool thing, and I really like using it. So I hope it gets out everywhere. It will. It's just taking much longer than we would really like. And with that will do it for the news for this week. I want to kick off the feedback section with some feedback from Paul. A couple shows ago, I think it was, I talked about this really cool website where you could go get iTunes album art for your TV shows and movies. I think you could probably get album art for anything, because the website was using Apple's API to actually search the Apple Store, or the iTunes Store rather, for content. So for movies, TV shows, and then could kick back the actual artwork from Apple. So the very high quality artwork. And if you've ever, you know, put your own stuff into iTunes, maybe you ripped your own DVDs or TV shows or something like that, you know that finding the artwork can be a crapshoot if you're going through something like Google or something like that. So I covered this website, but then I got this great feedback from Paul about an app.
Hi, Adam. This is Paul from the UK. A couple of weeks ago in your Thing of the Moment section, you mentioned the website bendodson.com that gets all the high-quality iTunes artwork. I just wanted to draw your attention to a free app from the Mac App Store called Covered. I will add a link in the email, but it basically uses the same iTunes API as Ben's website. It's a really nice small little application that allows you to search for music, movies or TV shows from the various iTunes country stores, and you can just click the download button and it comes down in the highest quality. I used to use Ben's website all the time and it really is good, but for me, I love using the app and have integrated a workflow into Alfred, and it works really well for tagging my movies and TV shows. I just thought I'd like to share this with you and your listeners. Thanks a lot, Adam. Bye.
Hey, thank you, Paul. I immediately downloaded this app. It is awesome. You all need to try it. If you ever had to search for album art, just grab this thing. It works really, really well. And Paul, I think I'm going to have to get that Alfred workflow from you, because I'd love to automate that process and make it easier. So maybe you can fill us in on how that happens. Give us some more feedback. I like your tips. And for those of you who need it, I will have links in the show notes, both to the app in the Mac App Store and also for more information on their website. So check there And thanks, Paul, for sending this one in. You know, the internet can be a great resource of information. It can also be a great, I don't know how to say this, confuser of information. That's probably not the right way to say it. Basically, it can be a thing that can lead you astray in terms of information. And that kind of happened this week. I got an email from Kevin, and he has an early 2008 Mac Pro, the 3.1 model. And he's running the latest version of Yosemite and has a 1 terabyte hard drive that is actually getting full. And so he was looking to upgrade, but in searching the internet was kind of finding conflicting reports online about the size of hard drive that he could upgrade with. He's looking to move to a much larger drive. We now have hard drives available up to, I think, about 8 gigabytes is the biggest ones you can get in this day and age. Kevin thinks he wants to get a 4 terabyte, or did I say gigabytes? I do that all the time. Sorry. 8 terabytes. He wants to get a 4 terabyte drive, but he, because of what he's reading online, is worried that the Mac Pro can't support it. Some of the forums out there were claiming that Disk Utility would not recognize hard drives larger than 2 terabytes. And Kevin, luckily I can tell you that is false. According to Apple's own support documents, and I'll link to this support document in the show notes at maccast.com, you will be fine. Like I said, the largest drives I think you can buy are up to 8 terabytes. As for the limits on OS X currently, it's much higher than that. Believe me, magnitudes higher. As a matter of fact, where the 2 terabyte information may be coming from is back way, way back when we were still running OS X 10.1. Actually, 10.1.5 and earlier, there was a 2 terabyte limit. But when we upgraded to 10.2, that brought the limit up to 8 terabytes. And then with 10.3, it was doubled again to 16 terabytes. Now, currently, as of OS X 10.5.3, your Mac can support volumes up to 8 exabytes. And in case you're wondering what that is, that's 1 million terabytes. So you're going to be just fine. Some other limits that you're likely not going to run up against, but I figured we'd cover them and just make everybody aware of them. There is a maximum limit on a hard drive of 2.1 billion files or folders on a single volume. So there's that. Though there is no limit on the actual number of volumes that you can have connected to your Mac. Of course, with your Mac Pro, I think you have 4 drive bays in there, so you have that sort of physical limitation. But, you know, there's always externals if you need to expand beyond 4 hard drives. And I'm, of course, talking about the OS limits. I'm not talking about physical limits like cabling or connections or anything related to the interface. But just in terms of being able to use Mac OS X HFS Plus extended journaled formatting and all that stuff, you should be fine with any current hard drive, serial ATA hard drive that's on the market today. Now, of course, with your era Mac Pro, it does have a slower serial ATA connection. I think you're limited to 3.0 gigabits per second. A lot of the newer Mac models can do 6 gigabits per second. But even if you get a 6 gigabit per second hard drive, it'll just get downgraded to the speed of your serial ATA controller. So you don't even need to worry about those sorts of things. Now, if you do go with a much larger hard drive, where you might have issues is with actually mounting it into the Mac Pro. I was reading on a couple websites that some of the 3 terabyte and up drives apparently might have reduced screw depth in the screws that are adjacent to the platters. So you might have to actually shim that up with some washers or something to get proper alignment on the little sleds. I think the Mac Pro has these sort of mounting sleds that go in and line up the connectors on the back of the drive with the motherboard on the back of the Mac Pro tower. So make sure that you get those lined up and don't mess that up, because you could actually probably could damage your Mac sliding that in. And I was also seeing on the Otherworld Computing website that hard drives 6 terabytes and larger apparently have a new standardized mounting screw pattern that might not be compatible with some of the older Mac Pro models. Now, OWC does sell a mounting bracket that you can actually install a drive into the extra optical bay on an older Mac Pro. So I'll have a link to that in the show notes at maccast.com. So if you want to go even bigger than, say, that 4 terabyte, and you end up with one of these drives that doesn't have the right screw mounting platform, that could be an option for you, and I just wanted to point that out. Let's talk a little bit about passwords and security and storing passwords and remembering passwords. And I want to disclaimer this next segment with, I am not a security expert. If you've been listening to the MacCast, you know very often we turn to George Starcher, who is a security expert, to answer a lot of these questions. Because I'm going on vacation, didn't have time to vet this with him. And I'm sure if I get something wrong, I will get some feedback from him on this. And I will share that with you on a future episode. But this week, I got an email from Bill. And Bill says he's been using the old pencil and paper password memory technique. Basically, making a big list of all the sites and passwords and keeping them on a sheet of paper. He wanted to know, you know, I want to move to something more technologically advanced. He mentioned specifically KeePass. I'm a big fan of 1Password, and he had some questions about that. And I think it was also prompted by, he mentioned in his email that he recently had his Gmail account hacked and was really looking for a better way to keep track and sort of have some better passwords. And he did note in the email that his passwords are mostly, quote, easy to remember words interspersed with numbers and characters. And he thought that those were pretty secure. And Bill, I will tell you, actually, that's not really the case, especially if you're just using a single word, which I'm assuming you mean that you're just using a single word interspersed with numbers and characters. Because when it comes to passwords, length is really the most important factor, more important than some of those other factors. I'm not saying it's the only factor, but it's just the thing that you can do to give yourself the most security. Make a longer password. That's why many security experts will actually tell you to use a passphrase instead of a password. So they'll often recommend, you know, using your favorite quote and, you know, having almost a whole, not paragraph, but definitely almost like a sentence as your password. And really, the reason why is it's all about brute force hacking. How easy is it to run a program, have a computer in this day and age actually be able to go through and guess or crack that password? And what happens a lot is in computers, and I guess just backing up a little bit, is when hopefully you're logging into a website and registering and setting up a username and password, what it's doing is storing that password in a database, but storing it in an encrypted fashion. And then what happens when you go to log in is you fill out that little box, you enter in your password, and what it will do is it will encrypt that password again and compare it to the encrypted password that's stored in the database. And if those two things match, then it goes, okay, that's a valid password, and it lets you in. And so when someone tries to crack a password, they do exactly the same thing. They take a dictionary file, or in some cases now they have these things called waterfall tables, which are already known words that are already encrypted and that they know, you know, what that word is, and they start doing comparisons as quickly as possible. So hundreds or thousands of comparisons per second until they find matches, and when they find a match, they know that that's your password. And the other thing that they know in these programs and with these dictionaries is that they know all of your tricks. So they know that you're replacing all of your E's with a number 3, or you're replacing the O's in that word, you know, that super secret password word that you picked, with zeros. Or that maybe you're using an exclamation point for an L or something like that. They build those things into their dictionary files, into their programming. They know about all the different combinations. They know that you're using uppercase and lower, a mix of uppercase and lowercase. They know that you're throwing numbers in there. They know that you're putting symbols in there. So they factor all of that into their algorithms that they use to crack passwords. So that's all been known. And there's actually a great XKCD cartoon, and I'll link to this in the show notes at maccast.com, that talks about this. It explains this concept of bits of entropy, basically how long it takes a computer to actually crack your password. And they point out that, you know, we've gotten in this bad habit of telling people to make short 8 to 12 character passwords that are really hard to remember, but very easy for a computer program to crack in just a couple days using brute force. And actually, if they're using these waterfall table things, probably in a couple seconds. So here's a trick that I would recommend if you don't want to switch to a program like 1Password or LastPass. Here is a really good trick that will help you make a easy to remember but hard to computer crack password. And it is to use four words, just four random words that aren't related in any way. And one of the tricks that I've personally used is I will take the first word from the title of four of my favorite books, and I will put those together, and that becomes a password. And as a matter of fact, I've done this, and then to make it even harder, I've added a number right before the last word, you know, and then also a special character on the end. So what I end up with is this 24 character password that would literally take a computer in current technology hundreds of years to crack. And that's if it's guessing the password at 1,000 guesses per second. It would take hundreds and hundreds of years. So the likelihood that that password is going to get cracked is not very likely. And it's also very unlikely that any sort of dictionary program or lookup table that a hacker has access to is going to have that specific combination of four random words munched together. It's just not going to happen. So it's easy to remember, hard for a computer to hack. And if you want to throw in a way to have a password and have it be different on every website that you log into, because that's the other thing that I would recommend for security, is never use the same password twice. Another cool little trick is take that base password, that long thing with the four separate words, and then add a fifth word to the end of it for each website that you register for, and have that fifth word just be the name of the website. So if it's maccast.com, add the word maccast to the end of that password, that big, long password. And now it's even longer, harder to track, and it's unique per website. So the only issue that you might run into with the system, unfortunately, and I've run into this, is some sites limit the length of your password. So they won't let you have a 24 or 32 character password. They limit you to 20 or 16, or in really bad cases, they might limit you to 12, which is really, really annoying. So, you know, your mileage may vary, but in most cases, I've found most sites can take a very, very long password, and that's going to be your best protection against hacking that and using different password on every website. So if you don't want to do this, you know, then it is use a program, use something like Apple's iCloud Keychain, use LastPass, use 1Password. And one of the other questions that Bill had was, well, what's the difference between using, say, like Apple's iCloud Keychain for password creation and memorizing these passwords versus using something like LastPass or 1Password? And I will tell you, Bill, that really there's not much difference other than if you're using Apple's iCloud Keychain, it's going to get stored into iCloud Keychain. It's going to get synced over to your iOS devices and your Macs, and you'll be able to probably more easily access that password in default applications, specifically Safari, right? Safari is going to have access to that, although even that has changed because now that we have extensions, it's pretty easy to get at your 1Password password right from within Safari, and I'm assuming that LastPass does similar things. The other key advantage of having it in iCloud Keychain versus a third-party app is that when you're logged into your Mac or you're logged into your iOS device, they automatically have access to the iCloud Keychain, so they can use that, as opposed to if you're using a third-party app like 1Password, I have to log into 1Password to make my passwords available to the system. But other than that, not really too many differences. Both can auto-generate random passwords and those sorts of things. I happen to think that you can generate longer, more complex ones with 1Password or LastPass. I think iCloud Keychain limits the number of characters that it generates, and I don't think there's a way to configure that. But other than that, there's not too many differences. The other question that Bill had is, if I move to something like 1Password or LastPass, how can I update and find my old insecure passwords and actually get those changed, or find, you know, passwords, or find out about websites that I haven't used in a while and actually get rid of those passwords? And Bill, what I'll tell you is that I don't know with LastPass, but 1Password has this really cool security audit feature. It has a couple different security audits. It has something called Watchtower, in which case they have a database of like known exploits and when those known exploits happened on different websites. And they can warn you that, hey, you know, Instagram got hacked back in 2014 on May. And I'm just making this date up. I don't know if they got hacked or not. But if they did, it would have that in its database, and it could compare that to your Instagram password that's stored in 1Password and say, hey, you might want to go update your password because they got hacked and their database got stolen. So it can warn you to those sorts of things. They also will show you when you have weak passwords on a website, or duplicate passwords, or old passwords. And you can go in there and you can click on those and then just go straight to the website right inside the built-in browser, say in 1Password, and change those. So they make it really, really easy to keep track of that stuff. And the last thing Bill asked about was, you know, what happens if I lose access to LastPass or 1Password and it's got everything in there and I can't remember the password to log in? Well, that is potentially a dilemma. You know, you're going to have to remember that 1Password. But if you use the trick that I mentioned earlier, the likelihood that you're going to forget that is not very good. And you can still take that 1Password and write that down on your piece of paper and store it someplace safely, please. That's the only thing. Anytime you write something down on a piece of paper, you are opening that up if that gets stolen or lost or maybe even destroyed. And that was the other thing I was going to say about your paper list versus the, you know, doing it digitally. Because another thing people worry about is, well, what happens if my 1Password or LastPass database file gets corrupted? Well, your paper can get lost or stolen or destroyed as well. So it'd be a similar scenario. And you'd handle it the same way, right? You'd make multiple copies and put them in multiple places. So backup, backup, backup. Also syncing. I have my 1Password synced in Dropbox, and it syncs to all my devices. So there's multiple copies of that thing. And it's encrypted and secure until you open it up, so it's protected. The other cool thing that 1Password does, and I don't know if LastPass does this, is it keeps a history of every time you change your password, and it keeps all of those old passwords on file. So I've sometimes had to go back to those where I thought I changed a password and maybe it didn't get changed, and I can go back and I can review and see the old one. And then if none of that works for you on the digital side, 1Password also lets you print out all of the passwords that are stored in its database. So you could make a physical printout and store that somewhere, put in a safe deposit box or in a safe inside your house. The thing is if you've got all your passwords in there, that's going to be a big printout. As a matter of fact, I looked at mine. If I printed out my 1Password database, it would be 344 pages long, something like 2,900 passwords I have stored in there. No one could remember all of those, and I couldn't write all of those down on a piece of paper, so I have to use a digital system, and I would encourage you to check it out. You know, it's not as scary as you think, and it can help keep you safer and better protected, and really help you manage this stuff easier than I think even your current system of writing it down on paper. So good luck with that, and I hope this information helps you out. So I want to tell you a funny story. I got this interesting photo from a listener, Adam, and it was related to Siri on his Apple Watch. He was asking about the weather. He said, "What's the weather today?" to Siri on the Apple Watch. And he got this really odd response, and he sent me the screenshot. And as a matter of fact, I retweeted it because I thought it was so weird and I didn't get what was going on. So he said, you know, "What's the weather today?" And the response was, "I don't know where we are. Poop, poo-poo, poo-poo, boo-boo, 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 by MSN of poo. Let's use handoff to set that up on your iPhone." And it was like suddenly Siri had this potty mouth, or at least the potty mouth of a 12-year-old, and I was completely baffled and amazed why it would respond like that, and I think Adam was as well. Well, a few days later, I got a follow-up email from him, and he said, you know what, I think I found the answer to this problem. And he was going in to configure something in iCloud, and he noticed that poo-poo boo-boo phrase was listed as his name in his iCloud account. Well, actually, really his nickname, because in some of you probably are understanding what's going on right now, but for those of you who aren't, let me fill you in. There's actually a feature in the contacts on your iOS device and on your Mac where you can assign nicknames to certain entries. And when you assign a nickname to an entry, then Siri will use that as your name. And the reason you can assign these nicknames is so that you can refer to people when talking to Siri in a more natural way. So, you know, when you say, call my wife or call my brother or brother-in-law, what have you, that would be the nickname that was set up in the contacts, and that's how Siri knows who that is. And as a matter of fact, you can even have Siri change the nickname for a record, even your own record. So if you say something, if you activate Siri and say something like, Siri, call me Your Royal Majesty, then she will happily change your nickname to Your Royal Majesty. So every time from that point forward that you interact with her and she goes to say your name, she will say Your Royal Majesty, or whatever you want. So you can say, call me Ishmael or anything, and she will change it to that. So what likely happened to Adam is he probably accidentally activated Siri and then said, call me, and then started to speak something, or she overheard that phrase, and then it inserted or translated that weird poo-poo, boo-boo, you know, thing. That, or someone in his family was actually playing a little prank on him and went in and actually changed the nickname field on his contact to that. So either a family member or a coworker or somebody playing a little cruel joke on you, Adam, probably did that. But really, this feature can be handy, which was another reason why I wanted to talk about this story, for people in your contacts. And it doesn't have to just be for family members. It could be for friends. It could be for contractors and people you use quite frequently. So if you have a pool guy, you could put pool guy nickname on his record, or an exterminator or a broker. And then after that, you could say something cool like, Siri, call my broker, and she would know which record to pull up for you. So, and which number to call. So that's a pretty cool feature. And it also explained that weird, weird screenshot that I got from Adam. Another thing that I asked you for recently was feedback on your Apple Watch experiences. And I recently received this comment from Billy.
Hi, Adam. Nearly 67 years old Billy Walker in Kilkeel, Northern Ireland here. You were asking for responses as regards watch purchases. Well, I went into my Belfast store on the 24th of April, which was launch day, tried on all the watches with the help of a newly trained assistant. Nice, she was looking to. I chose a sport blue band, as like you, I may upgrade in the future. Got 38 millimeters. I don't have huge wrists. It arrived per UPS on Wednesday the 6th of May, and I reckon that's pretty darn quick. Now that it's on my wrist, I reckon I made the right choice. The blue band is to match my iPhone 6 bumper. I love it. And all my family are as jealous as all get out. During a trip yesterday, I was using the Maps app as I was proceeding. The watch tickled my wrist in time to the voice instructions of the voice of the sat-nav feature. Now, I reckon that's really cool. I'm now setting up the health feature as I have a weight problem. It keeps tickling my wrist to tell me to move. I'm trying to get more apps for it, but the App Store's not playing ball. Any ideas? I could fill a whole program with my stuff, but this'll do for now. And bye, Adam, and keep up the good work.
Hey, Billy, thanks. Glad to hear you're enjoying your Apple Watch. And I'm kind of with you on the apps. There are more apps showing up for me. And as a matter of fact, some are showing up when I don't want them to. As apps get updated and they add watch features, they're automatically showing up on my watch, even though I've told it I don't want it to do that. So I don't know if that's a bug or what's going on there. I've talked to a few people about that, and a lot of us seem to be having that issue. But I think you're right. There aren't many really great apps out there yet, and a lot of them, for me, are still pretty slow in launching. So I've been sticking mostly to Apple's native apps. There's a few exceptions, few little ones that I like, but not a whole ton. Hopefully WWDC will improve things. It's expected that Apple will have that SDK, the Watch SDK, for native apps for developers to start working on that. And as a matter of fact, Apple's Vice President of Operations, Jeff Williams, said at the Recode Code Conference that we will get third-party native apps for the Watch in the fall. So we'll have a little bit of a wait, but once that happens, I think you're going to probably have more Apple Watch apps than you know what to do with. On the fitness side of things, I just wanted to make a note on the, I know it kind of says, sounded like you're not really using that, but you did mention the stand feature or being notified to stand. Something that's confusing a lot of people is that that notification will come on even when they're standing already. And really, it needs to be renamed because it comes on if you haven't moved around enough in the hour. Basically, it comes on at 10 minutes before the hour if you've been sedentary for too long within a given hour. And if it does bother you, I've actually learned to cheat it a little bit by waving my arm around for a minute. So if I'm in the car or I'm sitting, you just start moving your arm and you can fool it. You can get it to think you're moving around and get that credit. That's cheating, right? I don't know. Maybe it's not cheating because I guess I'm actually moving, right? I'm waving my arm around. Does that count? I don't know. What's your thought on that? But overall, I would say, too, I'm really liking the watch. For me, what I really like about it is the stuff that it allows me to ignore, which sounds interesting. I can detach from my phone more, basically. I can get away from my iPhone. I don't feel like I constantly have to be checking it, that I constantly have to have it with me. Being self-employed and working at home, I now often will leave my desk without taking my iPhone with me because I know if I'm in the kitchen getting some coffee or getting a snack or something like that and I have a notification or a phone call come in, I can actually take it if it's important. I don't have to rush back and get to my phone. And that sounds like such a small thing, but it actually is very liberating. The other thing is when I'm out and about, I can leave my phone in my pocket and I don't have to put that up as a barrier when I'm interacting with people. I now that I have the watch, I kind of think back and I think about all those times when something came in. Maybe I was out with some friends and I was worried, oh, that's a notification from my wife, or maybe it's a notification from my wife. You don't know until you take that phone out of your pocket and put it in front of you. And when you're putting that in front of you, you're actually creating a physical barrier where you're closing off yourself from the people that you're with. And with the watch, you don't have that problem because I can be sitting there and just casually glance at my wrist and see what that notification is and know I don't need to deal with that right now. I can ignore that because that was just a tweet coming in from somebody, or that's something that I can handle later. Or if it is something important, then I can wait for an appropriate pause in the conversation and say, excuse me, I just got a text from my wife. It's pretty important. I need to take this, and I can excuse myself. So it allows you to be, I think, a little bit more polite when you're in public, and then ignore that stuff that you don't need to deal with. You don't need to take your phone out of the pocket, your pocket at that moment. So that's probably the killer feature for me. Some of the other killer apps, believe it or not, are in pretty much in this order. Time. Having the time on your wrist is nice. It's a lot easier way to check the time. We've gotten so used to using our phones for checking the time, and it's such a silly device to use for just getting the time. Watch makes much more sense. It's on you. It's right there. Again, you can just casually glance at it. Notifications, which I knew I was going to like because that was the killer feature on my Pebble. I too am enjoying the maps with the tap directions. I think that's really handy and helpful. Siri, just to get information, to do dictation, messages, and then activity. And you notice none of those are third-party apps, right? They did just come out with Fantastical for the watch. I played around with that a little bit, but still, because of the delays, because it's a little bit slow, it's just not a killer app yet. And I think once we have those native apps, that is going to change. But we're going to have to wait until the fall for that. But thank you for your feedback. And if you're listening and you have an Apple Watch and you have some feedback for us, please feel free, send in an audio comment, send an email, question, matcast@gmail.com. And I look forward to hearing from you. So the last thing that we have to do today, I think, is to finish up is the thing of the moment. We are going to do it this week. And this week, what I have for you is a new email client for iOS from Readle called Spark. And you may have heard other people talking about this, and that's because this thing is amazing. I never thought I would need a different mail client on my iOS device other than mail. And I know a lot of people really bag on and hate the mail app on iOS. I've never had a problem with it. I've always actually really enjoyed it. It's worked very well for me. But now that I have Spark, that's completely changed. I've actually replaced the mail application in my iPhone dock with Spark. That's how good it is. And it's because it has these killer features. I think they really sat down and thought about what are some of the pain points with mail on iOS. And they have a feature called the Smart Inbox. So everybody likes the universal inbox, right? This is your universal inbox on steroids. They automatically parse through things and put them into categories. So you have a new category for just the brand new stuff that comes in, and it's completely separated. It automatically will recognize subscriptions that you have. So if you have newsletters and stuff that come in, they're in a separate little section. If you have stuff that you've pinned, that's in a separate little section, and it's all there, but it's organized automatically for you, and it's really killer. They also have smart notifications so that the only notifications that you're getting, you know, for emails are going to be ones that are important. They're active threads that you're participating in. They're the people that you email most frequently. You're getting notifications from them, but you're not getting every email notification that comes into your box. And if you get a lot of email like I do, that gets really annoying. And you really can't control that. I guess you could kind of do the VIP thing with mail, but this is much better than that because now you don't have to relegate someone to VIPs just to get a notification from them. And it's been pretty accurate and pretty smart from what I've been doing. I don't know exactly what they're doing under the hood, but it seems to be working, at least for me. Some other features that are kind of great are they have quick replies, and you can actually do quick replies from the Apple Watch because they have an Apple Watch client. And the Apple Watch client actually lets you not just read emails like Apple's built-in one, but you can reply with dictation or these little quick replies just like you do in the Messages app. They also have swipe actions that you can take, and you can completely customize those. There's two on the left and two on the right. You can have multiple signatures, so it has signature support and multiple signature support, and it's really clever how they've managed switching between signatures. You just swipe. So you go down to where your signature is, and you can swipe between all your different signatures to apply the correct one to the email that you're working on. They have the ability to save your emails as PDFs. You can save to the cloud. That includes attachments, so all the different cloud services, whether you use Dropbox or Box or what have you. It also has an integrated calendar with to-dos, so you don't have to jump out to a separate calendar application to get at that information. And probably another one of the most killer features with Spark is natural language search and fast natural language search. So you can go in, you can say JPEG attachments, and it will show you every email that you have that has JPEG attachments or PDFs or find me emails from a certain person in your contacts. And you can combine these things together. Find me emails from Dave from yesterday. You type that in, boom, you've got all those emails yesterday that came in from anybody named Dave. It works really, really well. And here is the really killer part. If you're listening to this going, oh, this is going to cost a fortune, totally free. I don't know why or how they're doing it. There's not in-app purchases, at least not yet. I hope they add some because I hope we can give them some revenue for this thing because it really is amazing. They have these things called widgets, and they do have some additional widgets planned. As a matter of fact, the calendar functionality that's built in there now is a little widget. And my guess is that certain premium widgets will be charged for. And I think they totally should because just the base email application, probably a $40 application, if you're asking me. I probably would have paid that for it. I easily could have gotten $10 out of me for this email client. So it's really great. It's Spark by Readle. They make other really great stuff. If you've ever used any of the Readle applications, I'm a big fan of Documents, which is a document manager for iOS. Check that one out as well. And they're not, you know, I'm just saying this because I love their stuff. They're not a sponsor. I haven't been paid to say this. It's just a great application that came out, and it's my thing of the moment this week, and I think you should check it out. But with that, that is going to do it for the MacCast for this week. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors: Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disk Label, also Text Expander Touch for iOS, along with PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad, and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can check out all their great software, get more information and details over at smilesoftware.com. Gazelle is the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple products are worth by going to gazelle.com. And lynda.com. Lynda.com helps you learn, keep up to date with your software, pick up brand new skills, or explore new hobbies with their easy-to-follow video tutorials. You can get a free trial to lynda.com by going to lynda.com/MacCast. That's lynda.com/MacCast. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the MacCast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CashFly. They are at cachefly.com, and all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. If you have any feedback for me, a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can send me email. My email address is maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That number is 281-622-4269. 281-MAC-IAM-9. You're also welcome to leave voicemail on Skype, and my Skype username is The MacCast. If you need show notes with links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of The MacCast, you can find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And if you'd like to follow me online between shows, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can also check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast. And if you prefer Google Plus, we do have a Google Plus community. You can find that by going to google.com/plus, and that's the plus symbol, plus MacCast. But that'll do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.